Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at, we're a few places, but you can find us at kuci.org and we podcast at iTunes, Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher. We're all over the place. So you have no reason not to hear the show. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And today for the entire hour, I have S.M. Hulse with me. Her debut novel, Black River, was a Penn Hemingway Award for First Fiction finalist, an Amazon Best Book of the Month, an ALA Notable Book, an ABA Indies Introduced Title, an Indie Next Pick, and winner of the Reading the West Book Award. She received her MFA from the University of Oregon and was a fiction fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's an avid horsewoman and has lived throughout the American West. And she's here today to primarily talk about Eden Mine, her newest novel. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. I have to say, your book came in some time ago, and as with stacks of books, it seems that before we entered this pandemic, UPS and FedEx were throwing books at the door most regularly, and this was one of them, and I was pulled into it from the start. It's my kind of book. I love stories that have to do with, terrorism, family, complicated relationships, and yours has all of that. I'm so curious how the book came about.
Well, you know, it's always, I think, like a lot of authors, kind of hard for me to pinpoint the exact kind of mix that went into coming up with the ideas for the book. But I think it started mostly with the sort of question of, what if you were a person who loved someone who had done something terrible? And that can mean, you know, obviously a lot of different things. It's something a lot of people have experienced, but it's not something that I see explored that often. I'm really interested in writing about these big events like terrorism, but I'm interested in writing about them in a way that sort of explores what comes after or how the people on the periphery are affected. So in Eden Mine, it's told primarily from the point of view of the sister of a man who commits an act of domestic terrorism. And that was what was really compelling to me about this from the beginning.
And then the structure. I was curious if you think a lot about structure before you get going, because there's a few things that I found really interesting about this book. And one was the time lock. They have 30 days to leave their house. So the story is really compressed within 30 days. I mean, there's flashbacks and such, but it's 30 days, then it's, 3 weeks, 2 weeks, down to when it's time to get out. So how did that idea come into it?
I do think a lot about structure. I tend to, having now done two novels, I find that works well for me is to really think about the plot and the structure. And I tend to plan it out not quite to the end, but to kind of a major point of decision for my main characters. And I find that by the time I get to that point in drafting, I know my characters well enough that I know what they'll do. As far as the compressed timeline, I think this is something I like doing. My first novel, Black River, also had sort of a time countdown, if you will. And I think I like the intensity that gives the story. In one way, it sort of makes it just a slice of these characters' lives. But at the same time, it's always a very intense slice. And it's one where we start to see the ways in which the past is bearing upon their present. And it gives kind of an interesting frame, I think, to the ways in which these various things from the past or these various characters are all coming together and converging toward the end of the book.
Are you aware of all this before you even start? Did you know you had the time frame? Did you know, the basic structure of the novel before you began?
I do, you know, to a point. I do a lot of research and thinking before I write. I sometimes say this is why I'm a novelist, because it takes me 6 months of thinking to write a short story, and that's not a great return on investment from a time standpoint. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I thought a lot about what the story would be in that thinking stage. You know, things change, the things that you think it's going to be about kind of shift a little. But I do kind of have the structure in place. I find that for myself, in order to kind of start drafting and have it feel like I'm doing something worthwhile, I need to have a little bit of that roadmap in place for myself. I think I like that a little more than a lot of authors do. I'm one of those people who, you know, alphabetizes everything, color codes everything. So I like kind of having that in place before I start writing.
Well, it's also interesting because what happened to Joe, your protagonist, that put her in a wheelchair is given bit by bit. It's really the information, the storyline, or the backstory actually is just leaked out. And I was so curious about that too. I mean, if it were a short story, of course, we'd have to know really soon what happened to her. But just the way you release that information, I found really suspenseful. And so talk about that. I mean, this is a literary novel, but it's, I mean, I see it as, I think, did I read that someone called it country noir, which I found interesting, you know, because I love noir. And I don't know if I thought of that when I started reading it, but maybe I did. Maybe that's why I loved it so much.
Well, I mean, I definitely, you know, I think a lot about language. I'm one of those writers who will, you know, wake up in the middle of the night to change a word on page 137. But at the same time, you know, I love story. I mean, this novel begins on the first page with an explosion. So I certainly, you know, think plot is important and suspense is important. And I want my readers to be drawn in by the story and want to know what happens. And I do think about that with backstory too. It was a challenge to reveal kind of Joe's backstory in this novel, in part because she is a first person narrator. And while I want to create some suspense there, it's also something where you don't want to feel as an author like you're, you know, being too manipulative with how you release the information. But for me, it was really tied into, you know, as you mentioned, Joe uses a wheelchair and she finds that a lot of other people are paying sort of greater attention to that aspect of her life than she is. It's something she has been doing most of her life. It's not new to her. And in the same way, these events from her past, even though they were very momentous and had big impacts on her life, are not at the forefront of her mind all the time. So it made sense to kind of allow that to come out over the course of the novel as the present storyline is kind of pushing on this and making her think about it.
Was that always the beginning? The bomb going off?
It was, yeah. That was this originally ages ago, I'd kind of envisioned as a short story, realized fairly quickly it was probably bigger than that, but even the opening page of the short story was very similar to the opening page of what the novel ended up being.
So do you have just an innate sense of, I don't know, structure, plot, or did you learn this somewhere? Because it just works so well.
Well, it's something I'm very interested in when I read. You know, I feel like authors that people don't necessarily expect me to sort of name as influences, people kind of expect a lot of the other literary Western writers, which, you know, I certainly do count as my influences. But also I read a lot of people like Michael Ondaatje, who really kind of was interesting to me when I was writing my first novel to really be looking at his books. And he does such unusual things with structure. Obviously he's also a poet. So I think we see that in some of his fiction. And that sort of got me thinking when I was younger about like, wow, what can I do? This is my book. I can set the structural rules. And while I'm not doing anything that unusual in my fiction, the way he might be, I certainly like to think about how do things come together? How are these things put together? So I do a lot of that before drafting, but then a lot of it also comes when we get to the revision stage of saying, okay, where are these pieces going? Do I have too much of this one, too little of that one? Is this coming at the right time? Is that coming at the right time? It's certainly something I think about a lot. I do a lot of in the revision stage of making sort of lists of what are the scenes, where do they come, what do they look like, and thinking about what goes where. I really enjoy that. I like thinking about structure.
You mentioned Ondaatje. Who else is an influence? Who else influences your writing?
I read a lot of sort of the, classical or canonical authors, for sort of lack of a better phrase. As my graduate students know, I really like Herman Melville. They don't share my enthusiasm all the time. But, he does, of course, obviously so many things in Moby Dick that if you brought that book to a writing workshop today, it would be torn apart for all the ways in which it is violating so-called writing rules. So it's very interesting to sort of look at, well, how is that working or not working? I really look to authors like Flaubert and Madame Bovary, because I think he does such an amazing job of writing characters who could so easily become caricature and giving them depth. That really fascinates me. How do I look at these characters who might be smaller characters or might easily kind of fit into kind of a stock character standpoint and make them have enough depth that readers can't just sort of say, oh, I know who this is, and move on.
And then the tense. I noticed that you wrote the novel in first person present tense, which is another favorite of mine, and it's so hard to pull off. Talk about that. Talk about choosing the point of view.
So that was, I wrote it originally in third person past tense. And as I now tell my students, pro writing tip, pick your correct point of view before writing the entire novel. I think I did that partly because when I've written short fiction, I've usually written in first person, but my first novel was in third person. So I think, I came to the second novel thinking, well, you write novels in third person. And I did that, and it just really didn't work at all. It became apparent that sort of a lot of what I, had envisioned as far as Jo's character was remaining in my head and not on the page, and readers couldn't really connect with her, understand her. So the shift to first person was fairly easy. The present tense I was a little more hesitant to do. I wondered about my personal ability to sustain that over the course of the novel, but I tried rewriting, 50 pages or so that way, showed it to a few people, kind of secretly hoping they would say this doesn't work so I wouldn't have to change the entire manuscript. But everyone loved it. And I think it works with what we were talking about earlier, which is that compressed sort of time frame this novel has. It does sort of bring us kind of into the present moments with Jo, because the novel opens with this explosion and it becomes clear fairly quickly that her brother is the perpetrator. She's sort of in a state of shock at the beginning of the novel. I felt the present tense kind of helped me convey that sort of sense of everything shifting, everything being kind of up for change that she's feeling through a lot of the novel.
And then we get her brother's point of view through his letters. And it doesn't happen for a while, as I recall. And when we start getting his letters, I thought that was just a great device to bring him in without him being there and without doing flashbacks. She doesn't read his letters, but he's writing them.
Yeah, I really enjoyed kind of that opportunity they presented to show the reader something that Jo isn't seeing at the time. And it did also seem important to both have his voice in the novel, but not have too much of his voice in the novel. He's, kind of a strong personality, to say the least, has, pretty fringe radical opinions. So he was a bit of a challenge to write sometimes. It was difficult to kind of convey, that he is both this family member that my main character cares very deeply about and also someone who has done something really terrible with really awful consequences. So I liked having the opportunity to bring his voice in small pieces and show the reader kind of both sides of him, the brother who cares about his sister, but also this person who has a lot of hate inside of him.
Yeah, I love their relationship because it is complicated. He's committed this terrorist act, and yet he loves her, and everything she remembers about him or tells us about him is just really loving. You know, he took care of her. He committed an act earlier that we learn about because to protect her. Talk about really developing his character so that it is complicated. He's not this two-dimensional villain who did this awful thing.
Well, and I loved exploring that through Jo's point of view, because in some ways it's kind of a coming of age novel for her. She's in her early 20s. She has in some ways been very dependent on him for much of her life. And I see a lot of her journey as kind of trying to reconcile these two things. Her brother is someone she loves. Her brother is someone who has done something really terrible that is inexcusable. And we see her kind of wrestling with that, trying to reconcile the way he has treated her throughout her life, which has been very, you know, positive. He's been very devoted, but also facing the reality of what he's done and recognizing that she can't just sort of justify it. She can't ignore it. She really needs, over the course of the novel, to kind of recognize both of those facets of him and that they, you know, are existing in the same person. And that's not an easy thing, you know, for her to do. I don't imagine it would be an easy thing for anyone to do. But it made him really interesting to me and interesting to write. And, you know, we see some of the reasons he may have become the man he does, but even that, you know, doesn't entirely satisfy, as I don't think, you know, anytime someone commits an act like that, there's never really an explanation, I think, that feels entirely satisfying to other people. And Jo has to deal with that as well.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear you read from Eden Mine.
All right. I would love to just read the beginning here.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
All right, here's the opening of Eden Mine.
Okay.
My brother's bomb explodes at 10:16 on a late April Sunday morning. I don't know. I'm 150 miles northwest in the house he and I share. I've just taped together the first cardboard moving box, and it sits on the hardwood before me, yawning empty. Later, I'll imagine the explosion with such regularity and intensity, the details become etched in my mind alongside my own memories, sharp-edged and indelible. I'll be hounded by those details, haunted. The shattering glass, thousands of jagged pieces slicing the air, capturing and fracturing the light, the enormity of the sound, the brute physicality of it, and then its numbing absence, the clouding dust, the crumbling rubble, the blood. But at 10:16, I know nothing, packing my biggest problem. 12 injured, one critically, a child, the daughter of the pastor of the church across the street from the bomb. Services barely begun, only the first hymn sung, the first reading spoken. The child's father prays over her for the 3 minutes it takes her to lose consciousness, for the 4 minutes more it takes the paramedics to arrive. He cradles her as he prays, and he'll find flecks of red on his skin and under his nails for days afterward. So much blood, he will say, so fast. I don't know any of this. There's no tingle at the back of my neck, no sudden catch of breath at the moment of detonation. I have no idea, none. Until the radio cuts off the newest country star in the midst of his climb up the weekly countdown, replaces his easy twang with the clipped voice of a reporter. If my gut contracts when I hear the word courthouse, it is only because we got bad news there not long ago. If I try calling Samuel's cell phone and then try again and again, it is simply because a person wants to talk to family after a disaster like this, and he is the only family I have. And if what I feel when the knock comes and I open the door to the sheriff is not exactly surprise, well, that's just the shock.
Thank you so much. That was S.M. Hulse reading from Eden Mine. And so now being on the second page with what comes next, Jo, what can I say to you? When I first read this, I mean, I've only read the book once so far, and I didn't realize that was Samuel, that you're starting the letters. But as I was reading it, I didn't know what it was. It was just a nice kind of, bit of suspense. What is this? Who is this talking?
Yeah, I really enjoy having kind of a dominant voice in the fiction, but bringing in a couple of the other ones. You know, we mentioned we get a little bit of Samuel's letters, and we get a little bit of a third character, Asa, the pastor of the church, who was just mentioned in the reading. We get a couple very short sections from him too. So I've really enjoyed kind of exploring that dynamic in fiction where there's one primary point of view character, but we still see a little bit from some of the other characters as well.
And then there's Sheriff Hawkins, who's a wonderful character. He's a sheriff, but he's a longtime family friend.
Hawkins was a lot of fun for me to write. I'm really interested, as someone who writes about the contemporary West, in kind of the ways in which these stories or mythologies that have been built up about the American West kind of impact people who live there or grow up there today. And Hawkins was a great way for me to explore this because he is the sheriff. He kind of fulfills some of these stereotypes about the Western lawman, but we come to see over the course of the novel that some of that is intentional. Some of that is him trying to make sense of the ways in which the modern West and the modern world are very complicated. And almost a wish for things to be as simple and black and white as they can be on TV or in those old novels.
Sure. Is Joe, or are you personally a painter? Because Joe, your character is a painter, and there's so much detail about the process, and then she gets into mud painting, which I thought only a painter would know all this detail and get it so right.
I am definitely not an artist. I wish I were. So sometimes I think this, my first book dealt a lot with music, you know, this one with visual arts. I'm really interested in writing about other forms of artistic expression, but I think a little bit of it is jealousy. I always enjoyed doing art growing up, but just am not very good at it. I did take a painting class while I was drafting this book, just so I could have a little bit of kind of the tactile and sensory experience of that fresh in my mind. But I did a lot of research, certainly thought about the ways in which the kind of creative expression I do through writing might be similar to someone who is a painter or a visual artist. The mud painting, I was very fortunate. I have a very old friend who is an artist and who does do some mud painting. Sarah Jackson, I thank her in the acknowledgments, and she was willing to share with me a little bit about that process and what that can look like and feel like. And some of those details made it into the book.
I was sure you were a painter, so it was great. Well, you did a great job with that. There's hardly any chapter breaks as well, and that was curious. How did you decide on that?
I think going back to thinking about it structurally, I did start thinking of it more in these sort of parts, these kind of different sections, sort of the immediate experience of learning about this terrorist act that Joe's brother had committed, and then a couple middle sections where she's kind of trying to reconcile some of those issues we were talking about earlier, figuring out who her brother really is and what her attitude should be toward him, getting to see the consequences of what he has done over the course of the novel. Joe gets to know Asa, the pastor, and really sees up close some of the consequences of what her brother has done. And then a final section that I won't talk too much about. And so it just seemed natural once writing it to not further break those up into chapters. There are a lot of scene breaks, so I like to tell people there's still somewhere to put your bookmark if you need to. but it's one of those things that I sort of just didn't even, my first book is similar too, and I almost didn't even realize I hadn't put chapter breaks in that one until an editor mentioned it. It's something I thought about doing with this one, but I think the way I think about structure and the way I like to think about the smaller pieces creating the whole, it feels a little artificial to put the chapter breaks in there for me.
Yeah, I thought it worked though. As you said, there are scene breaks. And so it's not this endless sort of ongoing narrative without anywhere to take a breath.
Mm-hmm. And I like to kind of think about sort of different kinds of scene breaks, you know, the little symbols they put in there are a little different for different kinds of scene breaks. So I think it still sort of has some of those arcs within the arcs, and there are places that kind of feel like natural resting spots. It just didn't feel necessary to make them their own chapters.
Yeah, yeah. You know, back to country noir. You laughed when I mentioned that, and I'm curious if you read noir, if that's something that interests you, and were you interested in bringing in any sort of noir aspects or shadings into Eat and Mine?
I don't think it's something I thought of in those terms. I grew up watching a lot of film noir with my dad. I've seen many, many, many Humphrey Bogart movies. And loved them. And I also really like sort of a lot of the kind of classic Westerns. And so I do think I'm kind of interested in sort of genre, and where, of course, we draw those lines between genre and literary fiction. You know, it's always interesting to me sometimes when I do meet readers or do interviews, and sometimes people almost express surprise, oh, you're a literary author, but there is a lot of suspense, or oh, it is a page turner. And I certainly don't think those things should be mutually exclusive in any way. And I do think that, you know, the books that I write certainly involve some dark subject matter, and the characters go to some dark places, but at the same time, I hope that they ultimately, you know, feel hopeful and redemptive in some way, or at least that there are hints of that being a possibility. So I think a lot about kind of the ways in which some of those genre conventions can play into the literary fiction, but it's not usually something I think about at the drafting stage.
Yeah, and the ending is not a noir ending, you know. I mean, you know, noir, it's like things go from bad to worse. And it does do that in the novel, but then, you know, it has the arc. Jo has a character arc where she has to make a decision, and I think her decision, I don't know, was a little surprising, but right, in what she had to do there at the end, and I probably shouldn't say more than that, but but talk about her character arc, and again, how much you needed to know before you could write the book, and how much of it was discovery for you.
I really, you know, loved writing her as a character, because I think, you know, as it's probably apparent at this point, I mean, I really do love sort of complicated situations, complicated characters, stories that don't necessarily have the easy solution. You know, I try and avoid the kind of easy solutions or easy claims in my books. And so Jo is interesting to me as a character because in some ways she's, you know, extremely independent. She's very capable. But she doesn't always see herself that way. She has relied a lot on her older brother to care for her and to make important decisions. He is significantly older than her. He has been her guardian for much of her life. She is kind of used to ceding a lot of that to him. And then, of course, on page one, it becomes apparent, well, you can't do that anymore for a couple reasons. One, he's shown himself to have, shall we say, terrible judgment. At least in some realms, and he's gone. He's in hiding for much of the book. And so she's suddenly faced with, you know, having to do a lot of things on her own that she maybe wouldn't have done before, but also being able to do that. As we've mentioned, she's a character who uses a wheelchair, and it was interesting to see how she kind of perceives herself in that way versus how others see her. We don't actually learn that about her until sometime into the book. Right. And that was, you know, very intentional. It's not something that's at the forefront of her mind all the time. It's not the most important thing about herself from her own perspective. So it didn't make sense to have it really early from a first person perspective. We learn it when another character notices. So all of those things were kind of in play here to see the way in which she deals with this situation she's found herself in, how she kind of thinks of her relationship with her brother, the way it has been, the way it's going to change, and what her responsibilities are that kind of lead us to that decision. I mean, I'm glad to hear that it did feel a little surprising, because I think she surprises herself a little bit in that moment. But at the same time, I think there's a little bit of an inevitability by that time for her character.
Yeah, and there's also while Asa Truth is a pastor, there is this thread running through it of faith. And what does that mean? And I love this line. It's on 156. She's thinking about Asa and, you know, what it means being a pastor, because especially given what has happened to his daughter. And she says, I don't understand belief, why it comes to some people and not others, why tragedy strengthens it in some and shatters it in others. I love that line. I put an exclamation point beside it, and I never use exclamation points, I have to say. Talk about that. Talk about sort of the two of them together, her dealing with him, and you know, they only grow close to a certain extent. I mean, they don't become great friends, but she has insight into him, or is trying to understand.
Yeah, I think, a lot of the characters in this novel are wrestling with belief or faith in some sense, not necessarily religious. Even Samuel, we see that throughout the course of his life, he's been sort of looking for meaning in a lot of different places, and ultimately seems to find it in a not good place in some of this extremist ideology. But it's definitely a book that is kind of interested in, why are these questions important? Why are people seekers? The friendship between Joe and Asa I thought was interesting to write for a lot of reasons. Most obviously that she is the sister of a man who set off a bomb, and he is the father of a daughter who was injured by that bomb. So it's, you know, an unlikely friendship, to say the least, and one that remains tentative for much of the book. But they're interesting together, specifically with that faith question, I think, because Joe is, you know, certainly agnostic. She is not a particularly religious person. She doesn't really think in those terms. She's kind of skeptical of it, and even suspicious of it at times. Whereas Asa is a character who we learn has, you know, based a lot of his religious belief on an experience he had when he was young, in which he believes he healed someone by the laying on of hands. And then, of course, he's wrestling with that faith in this book because he finds that he can't heal his daughter in the same way. And that really creates a lot of doubt for him. So I really enjoyed sort of writing him, because it's not a question for him of sort of having or losing faith. It's about kind of his faith being transformed. His faith, you know, the way he's understood it for much of his life no longer seems to work, but he needs to find a new way to understand those things. And so he was very interesting in that way. And he and Joe kind of recognizing these sort of questions or these seeking elements in each other was interesting to write. You know, they have different perspectives on the nature of faith, on healing. And I think one of the things that was most interesting to write is it becomes very clear that even though Joe doesn't share his faith, she recognizes how important it is to him, and she doesn't want him to lose it.
That's really interesting. There's also a lot on names. When they moved to Eden Mine, Samuel brought the Steinbeck novel East of Eden, because it was the longest book in the house that neither of them had read. And your book is called Eden Mine. And so I'm so curious about the connection between East of Eden and your novel, Eden Mine.
The names in the book, the place names, I mean, part of it, yes, comes from, you know, there are a lot of questions about kind of faith and belief in the book. The reason Samuel sets off this bomb is that, you know, or at least the immediate reason, is that their family home is being seized by eminent domain. And so there's some kind of interesting questions in the book of, to what degree is this home in Eden? Has it been in Eden that they're now being cast out of? But that is complicated by all of these difficult things they faced in their past. The place they live in Northwest Montana is very beautiful, but it's also dying. It's not what it once was. It's a mining town that used to be prosperous, but has really failed. And so on that level, it's kind of doing a lot of thematic work. I also like that it just sort of did feel a bit like the kind of, you know, grandiose names some of these very small towns were given a long time ago. So on that level, it felt kind of true to some of the rural West places. Yeah. I've spent time. For the book, part of it was I just really liked that line you read. It just sounded good. but, you know, obviously there's a lot going on there with families and family loyalties and some of the biblical allusion. And so it was, you know, it felt like I had to just throw a reference in there.
Yeah, no, I just love that line. I also have to ask you about your name because, of course, S.M. Hulse, we, you know, looking at the book cover, we would have no idea, the reader would have no idea that this is written by a woman unless, you know, I have the advanced review copy, so I don't even know if your photo is on the final book, but I am curious about that because, you know, there's a variety of women writers who use initials, and you know, I think the first one I knew of was Essie Hinton, you know, The Outsiders, and the reasoning I heard was that, you know, boys wouldn't want to read the book if it was by Susie Hinton, and so that made a ton of sense to me, and I'm curious for you, why initials and not your full first name?
Well, I think the reasoning was very similar, you know, to the S.E. Hinton story. It was something that happened fairly late in the publication process of my first novel, Black River. I was asked by my publisher of that book if I would consider publishing under my initials. And it was fairly late. We'd already made up a cover with Sarah Hulse on it and all of that. And I was, you know, told their reasoning was that they felt that having an obviously female author name on the cover might suggest to readers that it should have an exclusively female audience. And it surprised me a little. I mean, that book, the protagonist is a 60-year-old man who was a prison guard, so it's not exactly chick lit. and I thought about it for a while because it was a choice. You know, it was something they asked and I could have said no. But I do feel that, you know, for me personally, I would really like my books to just be judged on their own merits and not on my own identity. And so using the initials seemed like a way to facilitate that. It has been interesting because both of my books have had an author photo on it where, you know, I have long hair and, you know, look very obviously like a woman. My bio uses female pronouns, and yet I have a lot of readers and even reviewers who initially assume I'm a man. Uh-huh. And that is interesting to me. You know, I don't know if that would have happened the same if Eden Mine, which has a female protagonist, had been my first book. I wonder about that sometimes, but it's interesting to see kind of the assumptions, you know, we all make as readers, I think, when we don't know some aspect of an author's identity.
Yeah, no, it's smart. I think it's smart in a way because, I don't know. I think women do have more male readers if it's unknown whether it's a female or male author, which is a horrible thing, right? I mean, it shouldn't matter. But I don't know. I think it's kind of a smart thing to do personally.
And I just kind of figured it allows, you know, I don't think those are always conscious decisions on our part, right? We see books on tables and probably make all kinds of, you know, decisions we're not even aware about. Is this book for me based on cover and title and author name? So it seemed like just kind of removing an obstacle to that, maybe.
Yeah, and your cover does look masculine, you know, it's like this landscape with the title Eden Mine, and it's really interesting. I mean, I just think the whole marketing of books is a whole other topic and interesting, you know, what the marketing department is thinking when they, you know, say, okay, well, what if we did this?
Well, that was my other reasoning, was thinking, you know, these people's job is to sell my book, and it's not right. Something I am an expert in any way. So, you know, unless I really disagree, I'm inclined to say, let the people whose job it is to sell my book, sell my book.
Exactly. We have a few minutes left with S.M. Hulse, and the book is Eden Mine, published by FSG. And I wanted to talk to you for a few minutes anyway about your setting, your ability to write setting. And on page 154, I mean, there's so much great setting in this novel, but especially for some reason, I bracketed page 154 that begins, it's one of those lush May afternoons. I wonder if you would read that paragraph and we could, you know, talk for a minute or two about that.
Sure. It's one of those lush May afternoons I simultaneously long for and forget once they're gone, only to be surprised and relieved by their return the following year. The greenest days can be brief in the valley, but they're intense while they exist. The few deciduous trees are heavy with foliage, the high sun intensifying the color of the leaves, and the meadow is a shocking sort of green, an exaggerated hue that looks like something from one of my brightest canvases. In a matter of weeks, the meadow will fade to gold, then to a shade that can most charitably be called yellow ochre, and soon after that, the burn bans will start, and then the wildfires. But for now, for this short time, the landscape is a kaleidoscope of greens, and I can understand the decision to call the place Eden. The colors make me doubt my decision to paint this final piece using the earth. Might be better to allow myself the full palette of colors, to capture a favorite season one last time in this place. But the mud painting has started to take on the sepia tone of an old photograph, and that's better, isn't it? A painting about memory, after all. About the past more than the present, or at least of the past as a path to the present.
Oh, thank you. That's a wonderful section. And I wonder if you could talk about setting. I don't know, it seems to be, I mean, there's different things writers have trouble with. One is dialogue, of course, and plot and this and that, but another is setting and really being able to see where your characters live, where your story takes place. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. When I'm teaching creative writing, I sometimes talk about how I feel like too often setting is kind of treated as a sort of a lesser craft element. It's almost like it's the, you know, curtain at the back of the stage that has some trees painted on it, so the characters aren't just like floating around in space. And I, you know, obviously think it can and should be so much more. Obviously, as someone who writes kind of fiction set in the West or Western fiction, you know, landscape often does get a lot more attention and setting gets a lot more attention. In this book, you know, it was an advantage to me to have a main character who is an artist, because it made sense that she would be really noticing the place around her. Be noticing colors, be thinking about sort of what all of this looks like and what it means. And that, you know, gave me a lot of freedom in my descriptions as a writer. It's also interesting in this book, I think, because I, you know, again, kind of coming back to that interest I have in myths of the West and the realities of the West, this Montana kind of portrayed in this book is both a place that is extremely beautiful in a unique way, but also a place that can be very difficult to live in and has some challenges and has some areas that don't look so great. And portraying both of those was really important to me. You know, Joe as a protagonist was interesting, you know, because she lives with a disability in a very rural place. You know, she recognizes that this is not a place that has some of the accommodations available to her that might exist in a city, but she really considers this home and is extremely reluctant to leave. So there were a lot of aspects of setting that felt, you know, very natural to discuss in the book.
Mm. Is it easier for you to write about a place when you're no longer there, or can you be in a setting and write about it and still see it?
Well, I've kind of always had to write about it when I'm not there. Both of my books have been set in Montana, and I've written both of them when I was living elsewhere. I would sort of love to return to Montana, but it just hasn't worked out that way so far. So, you know, it's interesting to me because I do create fictional towns. I don't set them in existing towns. They might borrow from real towns. People who know Montana really well are often able to kind of recognize where some of those borrowings are happening. But that gives me a little bit of freedom to kind of take different aspects of places I've been or places I've lived or places I remember and kind of combine them in a way that can be very vivid to me, even if I'm not there.
Mm. Well, I wonder as we draw to a close here, if since we're recording this during the pandemic of 2020, what are you doing? Are you getting writing done? And how are your days going?
I'm not getting writing done right now. I do teach at the University of Nevada, Reno. So like almost every other university, we kind of abruptly shifted all of our courses online. Yep. And that has been very time consuming. I mean, I'm glad we have the opportunity to continue the classes and we didn't have to just end. But this semester I've been teaching both undergraduate and graduate creative writing fiction workshops. So those are usually very obviously like discussion-based classes, a lot of face-to-face conversation. So figuring out how to do that online has taken some time and some experimentation, but my students have been amazing. They've really stepped up and, you know, continued to give each other amazing feedback and everything. So I'm looking forward to the semester ending, so maybe I can find some reading and writing time. You know, I'm starting to think about, okay, I've got a second novel out. What's the third one going to look like? But at the moment, I think like many people, there's more TV binging happening than deep creativity, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah. And I'm curious about the writing or the reading, actually. And if there's more reading, I know that I just, you know, there's so many books I'm into and still buying. And it may be just because I love books, but I wonder if that's the case for others, you know, are people reading as well as watching Netflix and Amazon and everything else?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I have gone back to a lot of kind of the, I don't know, comfort books, I guess. I've been reading, you know, genre Western, Louis L'Amour, that kind of thing, because they're, you know, I think like a lot of people, concentration hasn't felt like it usually is for me. But I've you know, been reading some memoirs and that kind of thing too. So little bit of everything, but I'm, like I say, I'm looking forward to maybe having a little more time once our semester wraps up and see if I can dig into something more substantial.
Is your university planning to be online in the fall?
They just announced this week that they're planning for face-to-face in the fall back on campus. So I think obviously there are a lot of questions about that and some things that are undoubtedly up in the air and open to change, but that's what they say.
Well, any last words or words of advice for the writers who are listening?
Well, one thing I always like to say when, you know, writers are listening is just, I think one of the most important things is to just finish stuff. You know, tempting when we're writing something and we get stuck or we're not sure how to proceed to kind of go on to the next project because most of us have so many ideas. And I think it can be cool to have multiple projects going on as long as at some point they get finished. I do so much of my writing in the revision stage. I have like 30 manuscript boxes of Eden Mine in my apartment right now. And you know, it's like all those problems and all those things that you don't know how to solve. It's like they can get solved in revision, but you have to end up with a draft to get there. So that's what I always tell myself and what I like to tell other people.
Do you write chronologically or do you write scene by scene?
I usually do write chronologically. I do so much planning at the beginning that it's the easiest way. And I think it also does prevent me from skipping the harder parts.
Well, I so appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. I love Eden Mine and I want to read Black River now and whatever you have coming down next. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, you're welcome. That was S.M. Hulse. Her book is Eden Mine, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Come back next week. We will continue to broadcast Wednesday mornings at 9. And